I hate to tell you this, but it turns out that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. I know, very disgusting. Not only is it extremely gross, but it also leads to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. If you get hot at night, you'll appreciate Miracle Made's self-cooling properties, which makes use of silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. If it's good enough for the astronauts, it's good enough for me. They are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. It makes a huge difference in getting better sleep every night. If you hate sleeping in bacteria, which I'm sure you do, or you're looking to get rid of your worn and uncomfortable bedding, you should check out Miracle Made. You'll feel like you're tucked into a luxurious hotel fancy bedding situation, but it'll be a lower cost than some of those other brands. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiraclemade.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and today we are discussing Abolition for the People, the movement for a future without policing and prisons, which is Colin Kaepernick's new essay anthology. We're joined today by 2 contributors from the book, author of Heavy and Long Division and dear friend of the podcast, KSA Lehman, and writer, activist, producer, and artist, Bree Newsom Bass, who is best known for climbing the flagpole in front of the Capitol of South Carolina to take down the Confederate flag in 2015. They both join me to discuss police and prison abolition in this incredible collection. The Stacks Book Club pick for October is Waiting to Exhale by Terry McMillan. We will be discussing the book on Wednesday, October 27th with Nicole Perkins. If you love this show and want more of it, like bonus episodes, a community of book nerds to share thoughts with, and our monthly virtual book club, you must join the Stacks Pack. That's a community for all things The Stacks on Patreon. If this sounds like a community you want to be a part of, head to patreon.com/thestacks. Here's a shout out for some of our newest members. They include Sarah Alvarez, Jessica H., Karen Brownlow, Sophia L., Olivia T., Brian Augsburger, Jess G., Andrea Mehta, Nolani Peters, and Jennifer Harris. I really could not make this show without all of you and the rest of the Stacks Pack. So thank you, thank you, thank you. Okay, now let's talk abolition with Bree Newsom Bass and KSA Lehman. All right, everybody, I'm very excited, as I always say, but today I'm really, really excited. I get to welcome back a dear friend of the podcast, KSA Lehman, and bring for the very first time activist, artist, writer, Bree Newsom Bass. They are both contributors to the brand new essay collection on abolition called Abolition for the People, the Movement for a Future Without Police and Prisons, which is the Colin Kaepernick anthology. So that was a lot, but welcome to the show, both of you.
Hey,
glad to join.
Super happy to be here.
I'm really excited to have both of you. So I mentioned to you off air, but I'll let everyone at home know this is the first time ever we've had contributors for a collection, but not the editor. So I'm not going to be asking the normal questions of how did this book come to be quite as much because they didn't put the book together. So we'll have to wait for Mr. Kaepernick one day to tell us about those details. But in about 30 seconds or so, could one of you just sort of give the people a sense of what this book is about?
Take it away, KSA.
Okay, yeah. It's, you know, I think Colin would be okay with this. It's over 30 voices, essays, pieces by people who I think purport to be abolitionists and who are wanting to talk to each other and talk to the world. I think in particular ways, what I love about what Colin did is that we didn't have to synthesize any of our like points of view for this book. You know, especially if you look at Bree's piece, I think Bree would say that. I mean, I should ask you this, but it seems like Bree would write that piece to, you know, people who really rock with her. I know that Gwen Woods would have me say what I said to Colin specifically. So it's just an opportunity, I think, for a lot of abolitionists to talk to the world and talk to one another via our own particular kind of sites of interest.
Wonderful. Bree, how did you get brought into the project?
Well, I just got a reach out from Colin and the team asking if I would be willing to contribute to this piece. And I didn't even know like who all was participating on it, kind of to Kiese's point. And when I saw, I was like, oh, this is amazing. Like, you know, I mean, I just think it's some of the most powerful thinkers. And I'm not saying that to big up myself. I'm talking about everybody. When I saw the list of people who I was around, I was like, you know, this is really amazing to have people in there from Mumia to Angela Davis to, you know, Derrica Purnell and Miriam Kaba. Like, I think all of that is like really powerful. And the fact that they let me write on what I wanted to write on.
Right.
You know, they were kind of like, would you contribute something? And I said, yeah, I really want to talk about this BS around representation and policing and the way that they are clearly trying to make Black people the face of policing.
Yeah.
And the politics of that. And they said, sure, you know, take a stab at it. So it's pretty awesome.
And your piece is so good, which we'll get to both of your actual pieces in a second. Kiese, how did you get brought into the project?
It was the same. Colin and the team messaged me, I think, on Twitter. And then Colin sent me a text asking me if I would think about contributing to this piece. And I was like, yeah, again, not knowing who else was going to be in it or what was going to be asked. And then Colin said, you know, I'm thinking what I want you to do is interview Gwen Woods. And I, you know, I'd read a lot about Gwen Woods and I knew a lot about Mario. And I was sort of overwhelmed at that point. I was like, damn, you want me to? And he was like, yeah, I think you're going to be just surprised. And then I found out who was in the joint and I was just like, oh shit. Like, actually, like I was kind of happy that it was like as toe to piece, you know, I had to interview Gwen and, but I was like, I don't know if I got the chops to actually like write a piece surrounded by these folk. But yo, I mean, it's an incredible book, fam. I'm not just hyping it.
It is
a phenomenal piece of organizing.
It is.
And I think art, yeah.
I really agree. And I have to be honest, going into it, I read a lot of anthologies. I actually really like anthologies, but usually my criticism is it's not cohesive or it gets redundant or something along those lines when I read an anthology. And for this, I got all the way to section 4 before I was like, wow, I don't have a problem. Like, I'm like really into this because usually I'm like after like the third essay, I'm like, okay, you guys are all saying the same thing in a different way. But what I found so interesting and compelling about the collection is that you are all really speaking from different perspectives about the same topic, as opposed to speaking about the same topic in different ways, if that distinction makes sense, which, and you've mentioned there's so many incredible collaborators and some of them are people that are, you know, household names in general, and especially if you're interested in abolition at all, like Angela Davis, Derrica Purnell, who was on this podcast. So everyone listening probably knows that. But then there were so many people I'd never heard of that I was really excited about and so many perspectives. And also on the podcast, Marlon Peterson is in the book as well. And I really loved his piece. So the collection is very, very good. I want to speak a little bit about each of you and being an abolitionist. And I guess the first question is, do you identify as an abolitionist? And how did you come to abolition if you do? And then also, what does it mean to you to be an abolitionist? Or who can be an abolitionist?
I arrived at abolition from the realization that we cannot reform this system. I think that was my personal journey to it. You know, like the moment where I really started identifying as an activist and like consciously participating was, you know, around 2012, 2013, the Trayvon Martin case, the case of Jonathan Farrell in Charlotte, North Carolina. You know, we just had all of these cases. And of course, I remember my earliest memory is probably the Rodney King case, which, you know, I was a kid at the time, so I didn't completely understand all of it. But moving from a position of like, how do we stop the police from killing us to understanding, oh, no, that's actually their function, you know, really. As I started to sharpen my historical awareness, being exposed to people who have been in that camp for a long time. And I think what was really key for me in learning this from following people like Miriam Kaba and Derrica Purnell is like, you don't have to have a solution. Like, right. I don't have to have all the answers to what the alternative is to know that this is, I don't even want to say it's not working because it is working. That's part of the problem.
Right.
You know, you're talking about a system that is a direct extension and continuation of slavery and genocide and colonialism, that the police in America are the direct descendants of the slave patrol. So I don't even want to say that it's not working because part of the problem is that it keeps getting better. We keep like refining it. Now the lead of the modern slave patrol is Black, and somehow that's supposed to be an improvement to the situation. So I think for me, it was that recognition that we cannot reform it. And I think I even say in the piece, like, what does it mean to reform slavery? Like, what are we reforming and why?
Right.
And I think that's how I arrived at the point of saying, like, no, I'm in the abolition camp. You know, I'm gonna move over here from the reformist folks to the folks who are saying we cannot actually reform this, nor should we.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, Kiese, do you want to answer about abolition in your journey there?
Yeah, you know, for the longest, I was clear that I didn't believe in police, prisons, bullets, or guns. Like, I don't have particular relationships with all of those, but I didn't believe in them. But for the longest, I wouldn't call myself an abolitionist because, like Bree, I thought that meant that I had to have formulated an alternative to police, prisons, bullets, and guns. And then once I realized that the people who were thinking about their relationships and our collective relationships to a tomorrow where that shit doesn't exist call themselves abolitionists, I felt okay calling myself an abolitionist. But I'm still one of those people who doesn't want the title to do the work. So you know what I mean? Like, I'm an abolitionist, but I would never like foreground that when I'm talking to somebody, because I think that, like, sometimes these sorts of titles need to be talked about and not just like proclaimed. But if you ask, yes, I'm an abolitionist for sure.
Yeah. There's a quote in the book, I think. Maybe I'm paraphrasing. I don't remember. My notes aren't great. But that Angela Davis says abolition is about rethinking the kind of future we want. And that, you know, that sentence is very void of solutions or very void of concrete things. And I believe I heard Miriam Kaba talk on an interview where they mentioned, we've had years and years of prisons and police, and they still don't have the answers. So how is this movement supposed to be, you know, why are we being asked to be any different than the system that's been in place? Why are we being for, you know, and not that we shouldn't be better, because I think that's the goal of abolition, is to be better than what we have now, but that, you know, these things take time and they evolve and all of that stuff, which sort of leads me to my next question. In reading the book, you know, and what I know of, so about prisons up to this point in my life and police, you know, it came from slavery, as you mentioned. And when I think about slavery abolition, I know that there was a long movement over time to get there. And then there was a war, and then Lincoln freed the slaves. And for the most part, slavery was abolished. And I'm wondering, is there a journey towards prison abolition that can be slow and go through reform? Or do you all have any sense that it might have to be like one day the president and all the governors get together and say, we're not doing this anymore?
Ooh.
So, I don't completely agree with the narrative that says Lincoln freed the slaves and we abolished slavery for the most part. I think that slavery evolved. I think that we ended chattel slavery, which was a specific kind of slavery. But I don't think, and I think we had a brief period of time, what, about 12 years or so, that period of Reconstruction where we were kind of dismantling the system. Right. And then I think that effort was overthrown. I think the assassination of Lincoln and then Rutherford B. Hayes, who pulled the troops out of the South, I think that marked the end of that. And I think the following century of Jim Crow, of the expansion of the carceral system, I think is what I would define as like the modern iteration of that system. You know, so I don't have faith that there's ever going to be a time where like the white power structure of, you know, governors and presidents and you know, the inheritors of the colonizing class come together and say, we're gonna end this whole system.
Okay.
Because I don't even really think it's about crime. And that's the other thing, like, you know, I don't consider myself an expert in this. Like I said, I have moved over to the camp of the people that I am studying and learning from. But I agree that I don't think it's really about crime.
Yeah.
I think it's about a system of control, you know, and in order to end that system of control, you have to address the entire system. It's tied to economics. It's tied to the social structure. It's tied to who gets to control the land and control the wealth. So, no, I think it's going to require a people's movement, a people's uprising, which I would define as what's happening. I mean, I think right. like yeah. the movement to close Rikers and all of these things. I think that's the movement, quite frankly, the same movement that ended slavery, because Lincoln right. didn't want to.
Right.
he had to be forced to the position, you know, that right. he took. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's so interesting that you say it that way. And that makes sense, because essentially what you're saying is that in name only did slavery end, which, you know, is definitely the argument that I've seen and heard from many people. Because the reason I ask that question is because the other thing that I've learned from the book and from studying from other abolitionists is that, you know, a society that has abolition, that has no police, no prisons, can't have racism or capitalism and all these other things. Like, those two things can't function together is sort of the understanding that I've seen. But I'm wondering, like, can we abolish prisons and policing and like work on the other stuff? Or do you think we have to like eradicate all of that stuff to even arrive at a place where prisons are gone? Does that make sense?
I think we have to attempt to eradicate all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And this is what's so pernicious about policing and carcerality. Like, if you take it back centuries and centuries, like not only is it not solely reacting to what we call quote unquote crime, I think the argument can be made that policing in this nation and this nation state and this idea of a nation is always sort of reacting to organizing strategies. Like, it's always reacting. In Mississippi, you see this like completely, like, you know, like people always talk about parchment, but they don't talk about what parchment had to do with like organic organizing that was happening in the rural South. You know what I'm saying? So my point would be that like, not only are we part and parcel of long, long strategies of organizing, of abolitionist principles, of pushing back and reconstructing, but policing too is innovative because we have been so innovative.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's not about fucking crime. The crime is to have the wherewithal to say that this shit is wrong. So then that crime policing entity, I think, then morphs, as Bree talked about, right? Mm-hmm. That's how I see it.
Right. And like the crimes are changing. Like, I just was reading an article about what's going on in Florida with giving the right to vote back. And now all of a sudden, if you don't pay your fine, you lose your driver's license. Right. And so then you can't go to work to make money, and then you can't pay your fine, and then you end up in jail for a suspended license. And like, that's a new crime. That wasn't a crime before Floridians voted to give people who had been incarcerated the right to vote. Like, so totally that the crimes are evolving and the policing is evolving with the action that's being taken. That makes a lot of sense.
And in North Carolina, if I can just point out, they actually just attempted to outlaw protests. I think they attempted a similar measure in Florida too. The governor vetoed it, but I mean, without the governor, they would have passed that. They had enough votes in the legislature to effectively outlaw protests.
Wow. Which is just incredible, because allegedly that's what this country's founded on, right? Like, allegedly that's the First Amendment.
And I just want to say, and also I just think that also is what partially what is so insidious about what we see happening in Mississippi around a woman's right to choose. And definitely you see it explicitly in Texas.
Right.
Because it's not just about like policing, and it is about policing. It's not just about discipline. But now it's literally about making quote unquote citizens parts of patrols to get people who might be doing something that these folk deem to be criminal. But I just think historically, I just think it's like, that is our history in a nutshell. Right. I don't think it's new, you know.
Right. And how do we push back against that? Just continue to get more innovative, continue to protest? Like what is it, just one of those things that whatever we do, they are going to come up with something? Or is there a way to break through that pattern?
I do truly believe there is a way to break through, or else there would be no point in continuing to, you know, get to the
effort. Thank you for getting me out of the bleakness. I was going to a really dark place. I appreciate you. I was really like going to start crying.
Oh man, listen, I'm always warning people about like the bleak things that I say, or like my bleak analysis on, you know, on current things. But I mean, I do still believe at the end of the day, it is possible. I think it requires organized resistance. I think, and I kind of agree with Kiese, like, I view the situation in America as just like one iteration, right? That's like the modern version of things that have been going on with empires for a long time, like, you know, for as long as empires have existed. And I think that keeping us constantly disorganized, like you said, policing and outlawing the ways that we attempt to organize ourselves. I'm really focused on the issue of, you know, housing and evictions. I think that is absolutely about keeping people in a constant state of disorganization, constantly being uprooted. You see what they're doing with people in prison right now, trying to limit their mode of communication. You have to have money in order to communicate with people. Like, I think all of that ties back to preventing the masses of people from organizing in such a way that you can topple the ruling elite, right? So I do think it's possible. And I think if it weren't possible, they wouldn't put so much money into police and prisons. You know, they have to put so much in it because that's the only way they can maintain social control. That's the only way a few people can maintain social control over so many.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Reading the book and reading about the dollar amounts and coming, I mean, I think I knew it, but actually seeing like the like $34 billion from Homeland Security and like seeing those dollar amounts was really jarring, especially I just last week finished watching that Turning Point documentary about 9/11 and all of that money and the connection between, you know, Homeland Security and 9/11 and Homeland Security and prison and Homeland Security and the border. And like, it was really, it hurt my feelings. It was a lot. We're talking a lot about abolition. And I know that there are people who are listening to this podcast who are not abolitionists and they believe in some form of reform. And I'd love for you all to speak, because this is really laid out beautifully in the book, but I'd love for you all to speak a little bit about the issues with the reform mentality versus the abolitionist mentality. And Bree, maybe this is good for you because it kind of ties into your piece about Black people being the face of policing and how that's sort of a version of reform.
Wasn't that piece so good?
So good. Can I just say that? It's so good.
I appreciate it.
Oh my God. When I found out that you two were going to be on the podcast, but I didn't know, I hadn't read the book yet. And so I was like, okay, I just really hope both of their pieces are good. And I got to both of yours and I was like, fuck yes, this is going to be awesome.
Yeah. I mean, so I think the question, again, I would pose to somebody who is like, abolition sounds real extreme. Like, what do you mean about reform? My question is, what are we reforming? Mm-hmm. Like, what does it mean to reform, right? And a lot of people, I mean, there are people in my community, like, especially like older Black people, if you go to them, you talk about abolishing the police, their first thought is, well, how do we stay safe? You know, because the police do a really good job of coming into the neighborhood and holding community meetings with them about, like, you know, what they're going to do to make sure that things are safe or whatever. But let's look at the job that police supposedly do, right? So supposedly police keep us safe, right? They supposedly investigate and prevent crime, and they supposedly make sure that the bad guys get caught, right?
Right.
One, we're not safe, right? Right. So let's even say, like, let's forget that there is a history of slavery. Let's say there's no racism, like all of, there's no classism, there's none of that. We're still talking about a system that fundamentally is not working. Mm-hmm. It's not working. We're not safe. Okay. They spent the past several months telling us how everything is going up, crime is going up, even though they keep getting more money. So what you're telling us is that it's not working. You're proving the point that it's not working. Right. Then number two, they say that their job is to prevent and solve crime. Well, we know that's not true either, because policing doesn't prevent crime. Again, how do you spend this much money? The United States spends more on policing than some nations spend on their militaries. And we still have crime. So that's not working. And then number three, the biggest criminals in the world are sitting up in the most powerful positions. Right. You know, that's the thing I try to get people to see. Like, crime is this selective thing. So you may have seen this summer, they were making a really big deal about this one dude in New York who apparently was shoplifting from Walgreens. And I was I was like, the fact that y'all are trying to make this like a national story means that we don't really have a crime problem at all. Like, if the biggest thing is somebody stealing some deodorant, I mean, I read an article in the New York Post. They were detailing how he, like, stole some deodorant. And, like, I mean, I was like, really? Meanwhile, the president of the United States, the former president of the United States, is launching a riot at the Capitol, is trying to assassinate members of Congress, is trying to overthrow the entire Constitution. And you don't have a solution to that. And then the last thing I would say is that we already know that police, we already know that corrections officers and Border Patrol are engaging in lots of crime. Mm-hmm. They're smuggling drugs, they're committing sexual assault, they're stealing, they're lying, they're killing people. So if you don't have a way to address that, you haven't addressed crime, because your system that's supposed to address violence is only creating more violence, mm-hmm. right? And so again, I can't have to tell you, like, how do we end violence in human society? I don't know. I don't have an answer for that. I think violence has been a thing in human society forever. But what we can say is that this system that's supposed to address it is not working. Mm. And that is the dividing line between reform and abolition. And I think if we just get to the point of recognizing, like, this does not work, then we can have productive conversation. Mm-hmm. But everything that steers us back towards how do we spend more money on training and how do we, you know, maybe we, if we put cameras on them, they'll stop killing people. No, we've seen that doesn't work. Right. We just have more video of it.
Right.
So it doesn't
or the
work.
Videos don't. The camera is broken.
The camera's magically cut off.
It's they're always off.
The key moments.
They need to hide the on and off switch. My goodness. Like, solve that.
Yeah. Like, I think that's all you really have to understand to understand the difference between reform and abolition. Just understanding that it can't be reformed.
Yeah.
So what do we do? And I think that's the productive conversation where we're talking about, like, we need housing. We need, like, a lot of these issues could be resolved by funding other things. Let's stop putting all of the money into policing. You know, you're talking about $32 billion that went into Homeland Security. We could have housed a whole bunch of people with that. We could have provided mental health services for a lot of people with that.
Yeah.
Could have given free deodorant. Maybe you wouldn't have the shoplifting at the Walgreens. You know what I mean? There's a lot of things we could do.
Yeah. In the book, I wish I could remember who said it, but someone was talking about how also the reform idea is flawed because right now, even if you took the money from some of the money and gave it to schools or gave it to housing, that money is still in service of policing because the ways that our schools and housing are set up to police the residents and the students. And there's that great essay about incarceration. And then there's another one about all the apps and how one of the apps for the bail fund is the money just goes to people. And the other one is did you miss your parole meeting? And even those apps that's the one that's funded by Jay-Z. I think it's called Promise. One is called Appolition. And that's the one that's just here's the money. And the other one is called Promise. And that one takes the money and gives it to people, but also you have to check in for your parole or your meeting with so-and-so or your this or your drug test or whatever. And so even these apps that are supposedly helping to reform the system are part of the system, which is why so much of reform doesn't work, is because it's tied back to the idea of policing and prisons, which I had never thought about it that way. And I had a real mind blown moment. Okay. I want to give you a second to talk about your piece, which is so great. It's a conversation with Gwendolyn Woods, who is the mother of Mario Woods, who was killed by the police. And I have my big question for you is, how did she change how you think about sort of the quote unquote mothers of the movement?
Oh, I mean, Gwen Woods changed how I think about mothering and parenting. Mm-hmm.
She's incredible.
You know, I write a lot about parenting in this book I wrote called Heavy. And so earlier when I talked about, the 30 plus abolitionists, I wasn't sure whether or not I could call Gwen Woods an abolitionist, because one of the things that she says in that piece is, I know I should not say this, but I wish the people who shot my son had to do time in general population. You know, she's like, I wish they had to go to jail. And she's like, I know I'm not supposed to say that. And so it's not fair. I mean, I don't want to be just base, but I had not talked to anyone who was as sincerely informed and righteously fucking mad and use that sincere, informed anger to be clear. Like, she was so fucking clear, fam. Mm-hmm. Like, she knows what. And part of the conversation to me that really blew me up was when, yes, let's talk about Trump. Let's talk about Obama. Okay. But she was like, below, I want to talk about Nancy Pelosi as well. Right. And she wasn't doing that thing where I want to talk about Nancy Pelosi and not talk about Trump. But she was like, again, it's systemic. And she's like, if we're going to talk about systemicness, we have to talk about like the ways like a lot of these politicians, this goes back to Bree's piece, kind of like purport to be walking the walk, but we can see what they're actually walking and talking and doing. Mm-hmm. And this is what you did to my son, Nancy Pelosi. And now you want to throw on a kente cloth. And then she ties it back to structure. And so for me, it was just like, I'm not that clear. Generally, I would never be that clear if my child or my mama was shot. But somehow, like, she has channeled with Colin and lots of reading and lots of listening. Like, she's channeled that thing that I feel like Fannie Lou Hamer had, that informed sincerity, mm-hmm. that you don't get much. You know, you don't hear that kind of shit very often, right? And I wanted to talk about her kind of being like, I want them to do time in jail, because informed sincerity is not necessarily clean. Like, she can mm-hmm. say some shit that, like, she'd be like, I know you don't want to hear this, but. And right. I just thought that was great for the book as well. It's, you know, also when Colin says early on, my first attempts at pushing back were reformist. Like, right. I was a reformer, you know? I just think, like, that those kind of opportunities in the book, like, make the book not just, like, a closed tomb, but, like, a really sort of, like, fleshy organizing tool. And I think that's what we need a lot more of.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, not to promote a different book that I love, but Derica Purnell's book, Becoming Abolitionist, does the same thing, right? Like, you get to go mm-hmm. with her on her journey, which has a big pit stop at Reform Town. Like, she right. is in there and she talks about it. And I think it's helpful. It helped me to be more comfortable talking about my own feelings about abolition and wanting to be an abolitionist and, like, claiming that part of myself. And so I think that is really powerful in this book, is like the contradictions make it more human and make it more attainable, right? Like, you don't mm-hmm. have to be Angela Davis to be an abolitionist, right? Like, we aren't, if that's the bar, we're not going to get there, most of us, maybe just her, you know? Like, mm-hmm. if Angela Davis is the only one who's an abolitionist, the rest of us are really screwed because, like,
right.
there's one of her.
Right.
Bree, I keep saying I want to talk about your piece and then I keep not letting you talk about it. Will you tell us a little bit about your piece and why it was important for you to write about it and answer the very important question of, does every single major police department have a Black person who is in PR? Like, is that true? It feels like it.
It definitely feels like it. And even as y'all were talking just now, I was just thinking about how scary that, like, that's what scares me more than anything. It's like, it's not the Bull Connor figures that scare me.
No.
It's the way that they try to make the Black middle class the face of reform, right? Mm-hmm. And the sign that things are getting better. Like, you know, we have a Black police chief and we have a Black mayor and we have a majority Black city council and we have Black-owned businesses. And, you know, that is what we are inundated with in places like, especially like, you know, Atlanta and Charlotte. And even, you know, Chicago now, I mean, we see what's been happening in Chicago. They made such a big deal about the election of Lori Lightfoot right. as being, you know, the Black lesbian female mayor.
Right.
And this is supposed to be a sign of progress. And what has changed fundamentally for Black people in Chicago? Nothing. What has changed fundamentally for queer people in Chicago? Nothing. You know, what happens is that we just diversify the oppressive system. And so that was kind of, that's basically the point that I'm trying to make, is that this is actually very dangerous. Not only is it dangerous, but it's very intentional. It's very mm-hmm. well thought out.
Mm-hmm.
When you're talking about policing is still overwhelmingly white,
mm-hmm. right.
especially the unions. I mean, this is still a fundamentally white institution. And so the choice to try and make Black people the face of it is a deliberate choice. You're trying to strip the institution of its racial context, of its racial and class context, and give us this false sense of progress, that somehow the fact that there is a Black police chief instead of a white police chief is a measure of progress for all the Black people who are still facing violent policing on a daily mm-hmm. basis. And it's not. And that's one of the scariest and most troubling developments to me of like the post-civil rights era. It's like we desegregated these public spaces, but we never dismantled white supremacy. Mm-hmm. And so it's like integration became defined as, the ability of a Black person to be in a space mm-hmm. that used to be all white, but it hasn't changed anything fundamentally for the Black and brown people, you know, of the nation, of those cities. And so that's why I think we have to challenge it. And again, that to me is what makes reform so dangerous. It's not just that reform doesn't work, but it's that particular type of reform that is dangerous to me, because we're talking about a possible future where we're not even a majority white nation anymore, but we still have the same exact dynamics because all we did was diversify the bureaucracy that carries out the violence and oppression.
Right. And you know, it's so cynical too. Okay. Yeah. This is sort of a controversial question. Don't kill the messenger, but present company excluded. You only can pick one. Don't go crazy. What at this moment is your favorite piece in the collection?
Oh, man.
At this moment, you know, maybe another piece was a favorite at another time. They're all great. I read them all. But is there one that sticks out to you? Maybe not favorite, but one that sticks out to you as like was informational or really helpful, or, you know, just shout out someone.
I like Marlon's piece. I'm just going to say, I mean, the book blew my mind as a book, as an art object. Like I've not seen that book before. And I actually want to ask your question about her piece. But Marlon, I think, was situated himself to do something that the other pieces just weren't even attempting to do. You know, Marlon spent time inside. Marlon has spent lots of time, more than any person I know, trying to stop people from killing each other in his hometown, right? Of Brooklyn, and now the world. And Marlon is a theorist. So like, I just thought like there was a really fine mix of theory, sort of what we might call memoir, and just sort of like, it's like travel-y to me. So it's kind of like a travel narrative in a way to me. So anyway, I like Marlon's a lot, but I loved everybody's piece in it.
Yeah.
It's not easy. I think I'm going to go with Dr. Ruha Benjamin, the new Jim Code.
Because
I am like, I don't know if I want to call myself a futurist, but I'm very fascinated by discussion of future and like the development of technology. And that is something that's really fascinating to me, like the idea of, and frightening, quite frankly. Like, I think it was it Missouri or Michigan recently? They had a game, and during halftime, they brought one of those robotic surveillance dogs out to dance with the band. Yes. Did you see that? And it's like, wow, that dog can really do the running man, but it's also terrifying because they are like, I saw this thing on an episode of Black Mirror, and now it's dancing on a field, and everybody's like, that's kind of freaky to me. And I think those types of things are fascinating to talk about. As much as we talk about the past and trying to give like context for today, I think we really have to talk about where is this going? Because I'm just scared that it gets slicker, it gets more refined, it requires fewer people. And before you know it, we've eliminated police, but we're still all living under this like technological surveillance that does the same thing.
Yeah.
But can I say one thing about Bree's piece, Rick?
Yeah,
but,
go ahead.
So, you know, like one of the, because I wanted to say Bree's piece when we asked that question, but you said present company, whatever that phrase is, present company, not
excluded.
Excluded. But Bree's piece read me the most because I come from Mississippi, right? The blackest state in the union, the poorest state in the union, intergenerational poverty, you know, no Medicaid expansion. Like we're 50th in everything you want to be one in. And when you come from places like that, any black person winning, getting promoted, getting visual space in places we haven't, like we inherently cheer that shit, right?
Right.
And I think, I mean, Bree did this thing where I felt in some way what you do is you asking us not to be race traitors, but to actually consider what it means to hoist up black folks who individually achieve at the expense of all of us, which I think all of us have done to different degrees. But I maybe want to ask you, Bree, how do you, if at all, deal with that internal thing of wanting to see a black person, quote unquote, win, because we just, you know, historically have been made to lose even when we have won, and understand that like often that black person winning means more suffering for most of us, actually. Like, how do you hold that as a person?
Yeah, the Obama administration was the coming of age era for me. You know, because I remember, now I never was in the camp, you know, right after Obama won, where they were like, are we a post-racial society? I didn't believe all that. I was never like, you know, that to me was like, y'all are going way too far with it.
Right.
Yeah.
But I do remember like waking up the day after the election and thinking like, wow, like maybe we've like really turned a corner, you know? And I think for me, I think it was, you know, having lived through the Bush administration, and it was very obvious to see all the ways that the US government was corrupt under Bush. And, you know, kind of thinking in my mind, well, we just got to put some new people in there. We got to put some people in there who are, you know, trying to change things, and seeing how things didn't change. Mm-hmm. Right. I think the other moment apart from Trayvon Martin, of course, was Ferguson. Right. That moment, like those first few days in Ferguson, where this town was just like under siege from its police department, and there was just silence from the federal government. And we had a Black president. Like, that's when it said to me, like, wow, this doesn't change anything. Like, just because there are some Black people in some positions of power does not mean we are free. So then what does that mean? Mm-hmm. You know? And I do think that there is some power in it, because I don't think that we would have had the level of uprising that we had in the past years had Obama not been elected. Because I do think it was the combination of seeing a Black person in power and Black people feeling like we should have full citizenship, Black people feeling like things were more possible, and then running into walls that made people rise up in another way. But I think that we are also through that process seeing the limitations of representation. Like, if you are going to be a Black mayor, but you're not going to do anything about the police, all you're doing is acting on behalf of the white corporate structure. And in some ways, you become more dangerous because Lori Lightfoot's a perfect example. She's not the only one that does it, but she's a perfect example of the people that get in those positions. They act to the benefit of white corporations, right? And then when you call them on it, but I'm Black, right? Then all of a sudden, they want to embrace all this identity. That makes you more dangerous than the white politician who was there before, because he couldn't do that. He wouldn't turn around and be like, oh, but I'm Black.
Right.
You know, so that is more insidious in a way to me. And that's what I mean, again, about reform being, that kind of reform is really dangerous.
Yeah. Mm. Mm. Okay. I have to be annoying and take a break. Sorry, but we'll be right back. It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated. And AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Okay, we're back. Bree, I have to do this thing that might make me cry, it might make me emotional, but I have this opportunity to talk to you, and I truly consider you to be an American hero. Like, I really, like, your activism and climbing that pole in 2015, I'm going to cry. I'm so embarrassed. I'm sorry. But, like, to see a Black woman be strong and be brave and be powerful and to be the center of attention and to own that space for good, I really think you've changed who I am and my understanding of, like, what it means to be a Black woman. And like, we have examples in the past, I think, like, you know, of course, Rosa Parks comes to mind, but, like, you really embodied this moment in a way that I will never forget. So first, thank you. Wow, but now I have some, like, really nitty gritty questions that might sound funny, but they're not funny. I'm like, I've been wanting to ask you these questions since that day, and I can't believe I had the opportunity. But how did you know how to climb a flagpole? And was that something that you had prepared for? And because the action took place after the murder of 9 people in a church, did you always know that you were going to wait for a moment when people were paying attention to the Confederate flag? Or was this something that you had been planning? And I know that these things come out of collective action, so I'm assuming that, you know, this wasn't something you just decided, woke up that morning and decided to do. So I don't know. That's a lot of questions, but I just have to know how it came together. Like, I just can't believe I got to talk to you.
No, I really appreciate it so much. So my family's from South Carolina, well, from the Carolinas period, but my mom's family's out of South Carolina. That Confederate flag, that has been a thing for generations. Like, everybody knew about that flag. They raised it in the 60s, you know, to make it very clear that they were not with the civil rights movement, mm-hmm. right? And let us know who really ruled the day. And so that was always a thing. And at that time, I was organizing with people in Charlotte, North Carolina. We had an organizing collective called The Tribe. It was like Black folks, you know, working together, addressing issues in the community. And Charlotte is just an hour north of Columbia, South Carolina. So that's all kind of like one area, one region. In fact, one of the people organizing with us lived in Columbia, South Carolina at that time. So people have had conversations about taking the flag down. This is something people have protested for a long time. And, and people even have other protest stories about attempting to take the flag down. So it was something we had talked about, but not in any serious way, right? Until the shootings happened, obviously, and like all of this attention focused on the flag there in South Carolina. You might remember at that time, like other places had started taking it down. Yes. I think Alabama went out and like took their flag down right away. But South Carolina refused to lower it.
Right.
They refused to even lower it for like a day. They lowered the American flag and the state flag, but refused to lower that flag. And I mean, it was, you know, it's very clear the message that they're trying to send to everybody. And so that was when we got serious about it. It was about 9 of us who met that particular summer. And we said, is there a way that we can really take this down? And someone actually knew a Greenpeace activist in New York who had experience scaling trees. And that was where the idea came, was like, I think somebody can scale to the top, because South Carolina had actually designed this flag where the pulley system was on the inside of the pole. So you can't just like walk up to it and pull it down. Somebody would have to be able to reach the top in order to actually take it down. So that's how that became the method. And the Greenpeace activist trained me actually over the course of like 2 days.
Wow.
On that, we went out to like the park. I was climbing on a lamppost. And then we actually did finally find a flagpole at a school that I could practice on. And we were wondering, like, is anybody going to look over here and like put it together and see, but nobody did. And we rode down there, you know, that morning, Saturday morning, actually the night before, the Friday night before, late at night. And I went over there and took it down. And I was working with a team of people, you know, it wasn't just me, but we did recognize, like when we were meeting and talking about like who could do it or like who would volunteer to do it, the fact that I had ancestry in South Carolina, the fact that I was a Black woman, the fact that I felt comfortable kind of articulating why we had done what we did, that was how it landed on me doing that. Because we recognized we're attacking a symbol and we wanted to think about what are we showing people. And we wanted people to see a Black woman take it down. We wanted it, like, we're not waiting on the state of South Carolina. We wanted it to be a symbol, not just of that moment, but of the struggle itself. Mm-hmm. You know, just like, the fact that we have to just to take down a flag, like right. That's the thing that to me like continues to blow my mind. Even when I think about it, we're talking about a flag.
Yeah.
Yeah. They could not lower. That's the level of disrespect for our lives, you know? And we didn't want it, you know, they tried to have like their official South Carolina flag lowering ceremony, you know, a couple weeks later. But we weren't going to allow that to be the narrative because we know the truth. The truth is not that South Carolina led the way on this issue. The thing is that they were forced to do it.
Right.
Well, can I ask one question? Because I don't get much time either to ask. Okay, this is a Mississippi question. Did you think they were going to shoot you in your back?
That was my follow-up question.
Oh, my fault. My bad.
That's right. Take my job.
No. We talked about all of that. And I think, I always tell people, if you are planning direct action or something that you can get arrested for, or there's physical risk, you got to talk about all of those things. Like, what are all of the possibilities? And so even more than the police, really, we were scared about like somebody else coming by because there was so much activity down there, you know, at that time. And that's part of why we did it so early in the morning to reduce the likelihood of there being a lot of people around there. So, I mean, there's no other thing you can do in that situation. We had to come to an agreement that if somebody did pull out a gun and shoot, everybody would run for cover because nobody can help me in that position.
Wow. Right.
But you can't go into something like that unless we have all agreed that that's what we do, you know, in that scenario. And then, of course, we knew that we were going to get arrested. We knew for sure that like myself and probably James, he was the one that was standing at the bottom, that we would probably get arrested. But everybody knew that there might be a risk because we don't know how extreme they might try to go with the retaliation against people. So everybody was taking some measure of risk.
Okay. I have one more question about this and then we'll get back to the book. It's two parts. Part one is, can you believe you did that? And part two is, what was the view like up there?
Can I believe that I did it? Yes. Because I think now if you had asked me years ago, no, not at all. Because I wasn't even imagining being involved in activism or anything like that. But I think in retrospect, it makes sense. I think I've always kind of, and like if you talk to like a lot of my friends and stuff, they weren't surprised when they realized that I was the one that you know, had done it. Because I was often like, you know, standing up and challenging things or speaking out. You know, I would be the kid in class, like when they read something crazy in the history book, I'm like, that's not what my mom told me. My dream is to be that mom.
I want to be that mom so bad.
Right. So I think that was always kind of there. That element was always kind of there. And then as far as like the view, you know, South Carolina is really interesting. They have like deliberately not built up a lot of their cities. So from the top of the pole, I could pretty much see like over, you know, the horizon and all the buildings. There's not a lot of tall buildings there.
Wow.
And it just, for me, it felt like victory. Like we were obviously trying to make a social statement, but it was also a personal statement for me. Like I can go to, you know, Rembert, South Carolina and touch my great, great, great granddaddy's tombstone. Like he was enslaved there. You know, my grandma's told me about witnessing the Klan firsthand, you know, so to me, it was about like, I'm not going to allow myself to be intimidated in that way, right? Because what happened in Charleston could have happened anywhere. I mean, we were, you know, a lot of people are still meeting in churches. Mm-hmm. The church is still to this day, like one of the few buildings that we have in our possession in the community. So a lot of times, you know, we have community meetings. It's at the church. That could have been anywhere.
Right.
And Clementa Pinckney, I mean, I have like one degree of separation from so many of the people who were killed. Clementa Pinckney grew up with my brother-in-law's family. He was like the kid that everybody looked up to. You know, I know a lot of the family members of the people who were killed. So it was deeply personal to me too. And I think at that point in time, coming on the heels of like all that we had witnessed, you know, Freddie Gray, Walter Scott, those were just, you know, two of the cases that jump out of my mind just from 2015 alone. I don't see a future. I didn't see a future if we didn't take a stand. So, you know, the physical risk to me, it meant something, but it didn't mean much, because if people are getting shot for no reason, doing nothing, then I'm not safe anywhere. I'm not like, if I say to myself, okay, I'm not going to take the risk, I'm just going to stay here in Charlotte, I could still get killed tomorrow because I didn't put my turn signal on, like Sandra Bland or something, you know?
Right.
And I think that's, at the end of the day, that's what I wanted to communicate, is like, let's go, y'all. We can't do this another century. We just can't.
Thank you so much for talking about that with me. I'm just really touched and honored. And again, thank you for everything. But we have to get back to the book and to the important questions that the people listening want to hear. And we're running out of time, so I'm going to do this fast. First and most important, how do you all write? Where are you? How often? Do you listen to music or not? Can you have snacks and beverages? That part's important. Any rituals? Kind of give us a quick rundown of how you like to write, or at least how you wrote this piece for the Abolition for the People book.
For me, I had four conversations with Gwen Woods, and then, you know, transcribed all of it. And then I called her up to talk about the transcription, to talk about the shape of it. And then we kind of went through together and talked about what we would highlight, what we would take out. And did I have any snacks? I don't know if I had any snacks with that piece. I've been trying to do this thing where I eat ice cream with, like, I'm telling you all my business. With these little bitty spoons. Because, like, I think I told myself if I eat with these little spoons, I won't eat all the fucking ice cream up. So I've been hitting up these little spoons when I'm doing my work lately.
Oh my God, what is wrong with you?
It worked kinda, except if you go fast, it don't work.
What flavor ice cream?
Oh, see, I'm getting two parts. So it was cherry. It had cherries in it. It was I don't want to big up the brand because they might be foul, you know what I'm saying?
Was it Cherry Garcia from Ben & Jerry's? They're good guys. They're like they're like Vermont, like wokey woke.
You never know, you know. So yeah, it was Cherry Garcia.
Okay. Yeah. Bree, what about you?
I ruminate a lot.
Okay.
And I finally made peace with that process, because for a while I thought like, oh my gosh, I'm never going to be a successful writer because I don't just sit down and start writing. But it's okay. Like, and I think the little notes app has been actually really helpful for me too, because I'll just like jot some things down if a sentence comes to me or a thought comes to me. And then eventually I feel where I can like really sit down and write it out, you know, or at least get the skeleton for it. And then the other technique that has worked for me is sometimes I don't have a complete sentence, but that's okay. Like if I'm trying to get a thought out, but I can't quite figure out, I'll just do like a little dot, dot, dot and keep going. And that helps me from like getting really stuck. I can kind of just like get it out. And I am a snack monster.
Oh, talk to me.
That's
Let's go.
That's actually a thing in my marriage. So I'm coming up on like 3 years of marriage. That's one of the things we've had to work out, because I am the type where like, if something's sitting out for too long, it becomes free for all.
Slash yours.
I'm like, if something goes missing in the house, I am the one, like, you know, he'll be like, didn't I buy two bags of chips the other day? Yes, you did. They're gone. And I always have like a snack obsession, and it changes. So there's like one thing I eat like obsessively for like a period of time, and then I get something else. And like,
what is your obsession right now?
Oh my God, those Cape Cod chips. Please tell me that Cape Cod is okay, because
I don't know anything about them, but they're okay in my book because we don't know anything.
Please don't tell me they're out union busting or doing it, because that's going to be a hard
so
one.
What flavor though?
Oh man, I love the sweet jalapeno.
Yeah.
What is it called? The jalapeno. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Amazing. I'm so glad you guys eat snacks. I get so many freaking writers on here who are like, celery sticks. I'm like, get a grip. Mm-mm. Get a life. Okay. Mm-mm. Get a life. That's not even food. Okay. This question is also very important. And since both of you are very smart, wonderful writers, I feel like it's important that my listeners hear this from you. What is a word you can never spell correctly on the first try?
Bureaucracy.
That's like an impossible word.
I can never remember the where the A comes and the E and the A. It's always throwing me.
Ooh, mine is mad ignorant. Grief.
Grief.
I flipped the E and the I.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just discovered today that a word I can't, I mean, I knew it, but I really clicked my mind was publicly. I can't spell publicly. I'm adding
how do you spell
A.
It?
I don't know. I'm adding A's. There's no A, I guess. I thought it was like publicly. Publicly.
Yes. Right.
Publicly.
Yeah.
Apparently, it's like one L and an I. Truly, it was a mistake.
There's very little logic to the English language, though.
Yeah. Right. It's true.
Yeah.
It's true. And some people just are good spellers. And I've had some of them on the podcast also, like the non snacker people I despise. Actually, Clint Smith comes to mind as a non snacker and a good speller. Truly a jerk. What a loser.
I bet Clint messes up on it's. He just ain't telling. You know how, like, a lot of us put apostrophes when we don't
really. It's really hard, actually. Yeah. I don't know. I have to think it out. Okay. For people who love Abolition for the People, would you each give maybe two books that you would recommend for them to check out as like good companion pieces? And you can't say Derek's book because I already said it.
Okay.
You reviewed Marlon's book, right?
Yeah, Marlon was on the show.
Yeah, that's right. So
maybe Bird Uncaged, for those of you who don't remember.
So I want to say Bird Uncaged.
Okay.
But I also think there's this book called The Black Woman. It's an old book, 1970s. Okay. The Black Woman, and it's referred to. And I think that's a interesting sort of because it's a sort of compilation book too, with a lot of different writers writing to each other and the larger world. I don't remember who edited it though.
Okay, cool. Bree?
Let's see. I think I would say We Do This Till We Free Us. Does that count or is that not
counts.
Allowed? Okay. And I would also say, oh my gosh, why is my mind blanking? I see the book, but I can't. The Half Has Never Been Told. Has never been told about the connections between slavery and capitalism, because I think that there's very little collective understanding of how the modern economic and social system really is rooted in slavery. Like we're often told to understand slavery as like a minor thing or a side thing, and I think you really have to understand that to then apply that analysis to understanding why we can't reform this current system.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. Okay, this is my last question. I normally ask people who's the person you'd want to read the book, but because this isn't, you know, each of your books, you weren't behind it, I'm going to kind of shift the question to be, what do you hope that people will keep in mind as they read this book?
I mean, I'm kind of answering the other question. I mean, okay. I really would love for reformist-minded people to read this book. I mean, I think it's important for people who are already kind of, in the camp of abolition. But I would really challenge people who think abolition sounds too extreme or they don't understand what people are talking about to pick this up and read it. And what I would want them to think about is that we don't have to have all of the answers. People didn't have all the answers for what you do after you end centuries old chattel slavery system. I mean, people raised the same questions. They were like, well, how can we abolish slavery? If we do that, then how are we going to produce the cotton? What happens to this industry? And what happens to that? And, you know, you evolve, you deal with it. And so I would say, like, don't think that you have to have all of the answers. Approach it as a question. Like ask yourself the question, what if we can't reform this system? What if that is impossible? Begin with that question when you read.
That's great.
Yeah. I think I want my mama and her generation of my mama and her sisters and her generation of people to read the book and think a lot about how it's constructed. We didn't talk much about Tamara Knopper's like data stories and how they're interspersed throughout, but I just think that's also pretty genius. But I think it's important for that generation above I don't know if it's us or me, to actually have hard conversations about representation versus liberation. And I think they had those conversations in the 70s, and then they got fully employed and stopped having them, some of them, and or some of them got incarcerated and stopped having them. But anyway, so I just think that generation of people, I would love for them to actually read it and talk with each other and us about what we all have been trying to do at some points in our lives.
So great. Thank you both so much for being here. It's really been a treat. I will link to both of your social media and everything in the show notes so people can find that. And the book is called Abolition for the People. And it's really good. I was really surprised how good it was, truthfully. And I just really thank you both for your work and for being here. And everybody else, we will see you in the stacks. Thank you all for listening, and thank you to Kiese and Bree for being my guests. Also, a huge thank you to Christopher Petrella at Kaepernick Publishing for making this episode possible. And please remember, the Stacks Book Club pick for October is Waiting to Exhale by Terry McMillan. We will be discussing the book on Wednesday, October 27th with Nicole Perkins. If you love the show and want inside access, head to patreon.com/thestacks to join the Stacks Pack. Make sure you're subscribed to The Stacks wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, be sure to leave us a rating and a review. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. Our editor is Christian Duenas. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite. And our theme music is from Tagirigis. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.